National news from grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community radio news from coast to coast to coast. I'm Carrie Tatwini.
And I'm Julian Cooper from occupied Anishinaabe territory, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Niuak and Nakota at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba. In this edition...
When he walked by and shoved my drum into my mouth.
Wow, really?
I guess sometimes I'm kind of in shock whenever I see how many times that we stop, because whenever we stop, it means that they found another body.
It's very difficult for us every week to come here all the way for only 20 minutes behind the class.
Hidden homelessness is extremely prevalent, so many people who we might know, have experienced hidden homelessness at one time or another.
But first, here are the headlines.
A magazine article appearing on the stands in January painted an unflattering portrait of Winnipeg as a city with long-standing, unaddressed issues of racism toward its Aboriginal population. In this report from CKUW's Michael Welch, prominent figures in town are responding, and the newly elected mayor is pledging to correct the realities the article points to.
A recent article published by Maclean's magazine has caused a stir in the city of Winnipeg. It was printed under the headline, "Welcome to Winnipeg, where Canada's racism problem is at its worst." Some Winnipeggers have expressed outrage at the article. Emblematic of this reaction is a recent radio interview by Dave Wheeler with author McDonald. Wheeler stated that some of the incidents pointed out in the article were not actually racist because they were committed by other Aboriginal people. Much of the Aboriginal community, however, sees truth in the racist depiction of the city. The newly elected mayor, Brian Bowman, a Métis, responded to the charge at a press conference. The rookie mayor committed to tackling the issue and invited community input. He spoke recently at the 8th Annual Gathering for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women on Saturday, February 14th, where he repeated his commitment.
What I want to know, what I need to hear from you, is what tangible things can the city of Winnipeg do to break down barriers and intolerance and racism that we have in our community that affects all people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous? Please go to that website, onewinnipeg.ca, and let your voice be heard. And believe me when I say it, it will be heard.
From the heart of downtown Winnipeg and occupied Anishinaabe Ating, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Niuak and the Nakota, this is CQW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Next up, a report about a regulation that would put trans people in Quebec at risk of committing a criminal act and facing discrimination.
The Quebec National Assembly passed a bill in the end of 2014 changing the regulations that enable trans people to apply for official gender marker change on legal documents. While the new rules have not yet been enacted, the amendment to the province's civil code has already sparked debate in the LGBT community. In the past, people applying for gender marker change were required to undergo full sexual reassignment surgery. Now, the government will be requiring sworn statements from the applicant that they have been living under the appearance of their requested sex full-time for the past 2 years. Gabrielle Bouchard is the Peer Support and Trans Advocacy Coordinator at the Centre for Gender Advocacy in Montreal. She says the new rules place unreasonable subjective power in the hands of the government to determine what qualifies appearing male or female enough.
So what the government's pretty much saying is saying we will regulate how you can look and how you must look, because you must look under the appearance of whatever civil servant will decide.
Bouchard says that trans people should not be singled out and asked to live up to impossible standards.
We're asking one specific group of people one very specific requirement that is not asked out of anybody else.
This is Marilla Stoiter-Martin for CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Groundwire is looking for grassroots coverage with progressive perspectives, voices, and stories of interest to a national audience. By being aired on radio stations across Canada, your piece will do more than connect communities. It will encourage the self-representation of communities, and that is empowering. For more information on how to pitch a headline, feature, or community radio report, email groundwireprod@gmail.com.
Now it's time for our feature stories. Thousands of Indigenous people and their supporters held rallies, protests, and blockades across the country on Friday, February 13th, in a campaign dubbed #ShutDownCanada. The organizers hope, quote, to significantly impact the Canadian economy for a day, unquote, and call attention to the numbers of issues, including missing and murdered Indigenous women, the degradation of the environment, as well as new anti-terrorist legislation. More than 20 events took place across Canada, including in Vancouver, Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, Edmonton, Winnipeg, and Halifax. In Vancouver, over 100 people blockaded the main entrance to the port of Vancouver. Audrey Sigal is a Musqueam land defender and housing activist who sang and drummed at the blockade. In a video captured by Gennarji O'Sullivan, a police officer is seen walking into Audrey and pushing her drum into her face. Following the incident, Audrey appeared on Gennarji's show, The Spirit Whispers, on CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to When Spirit Whispers. I'm Gennarji O'Sullivan. As I said earlier, an incident happened at Shutdown Canada, which was on February 13th on Main and Hastings, where Audrey Sigal, who had formerly run for Vancouver City Council, was assaulted by a police officer. As he walked by, he shouldered her, causing her drum to hit her face and give her a fat lip. Here, listen to the soundbite that I collected.
Did you see what he did to my lip?
What did he do?
When he walked by and shoved my drum into my mouth.
Wow, really?
Did you get assaulted?
Now we have Audrey Sigal on the line. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Gennarji.
Hi. How are you doing today?
I feel silly saying I'm okay, but I'm disturbed and I'm shaken up and I'm angry and I'm disappointed.
Tell us your account. So what had happened before Officer
McKinnon
assaulted you? What was going on?
The two other drummers that were standing in front of me, my good friends Shannon and Savannah, were standing and drumming, and I was standing kind of behind the two of them, and there was one of those City of Vancouver dividers. It was just the kind of the sawhorse legs with the long orange and white 2x4 kind of thing that said 2x4.
Yeah.
And the officers were standing on the other side of that, and all of a sudden, it really just happened so quickly. Officer McKinnon stepped out from behind the divider, literally shoved Shannon and Savannah aside, and what you mostly see in the video is, and it's funny seeing it from that perspective, because to me, all I saw was him all of a sudden just advancing towards me so quickly, and his eye, like he was staring right at me, and he dug his shoulder in as he went by and shoved my drum into my face, which cut my lip open and left me with a big bruise, and my lip is still a little swollen and bruised, and it hurts to laugh and smile. I followed McKinnon and I asked him. First he tried to ignore me, and then he finally acknowledged me, and he kept trying to pass it off that it was my fault for standing in his way, and I said, so we had a back and forth about that, and then he gave me probably one of the most insincere and sarcastic apologies I have ever heard in my life, and asked if we were done. And I went to grab my purse and my drum bag and stuff because I didn't feel safe to stay, and I was talking showing other officers on my way to my drum bag, and I was in a highly emotional state, as I think anybody would be. And all the other officers that I talked to, the majority of them did not respond at all. They looked down. They pretended that I wasn't talking to them. A few of them actually laughed and mocked me while looking at each other. And two of them actually told me that I deserved
wow.
what happened. And I clarified with each of them that, did you just say that I deserve this? And they both confirmed, yep, you deserve that.
Wow.
And I said, okay, so the women who were getting knocked down, the women who were getting kneed from behind, pinched, shoved, elbowed, and knocked to the ground, do they deserve that too? And he said, yep, you all deserve it. At the rally, which was an event to call for an end to violence against Indigenous women, and the police, there were only 5 traffic police there at the beginning, and then they just kind of moved in the same people who were set up at who came to clear us out of Oppenheimer, and then. Once they came in, they brought a lot of tension, and they were saying really nasty things as people were going around the intersection and making jokes about people getting hit by cars, and just really inappropriate racist jokes and sexist jokes. And for me, it's just good to know the intentions and the mindset of this man who kept telling me his job was to be there to protect, and when I called him on it and asked him, were you protecting me when you gave me this fat cut lip, then he just kind of smiled and smirked and rolled mm-hmm. his eyes and looked away.
Yeah.
And he even made a joke that I was making such a big deal about it that I want him to call me an ambulance.
Wow.
What happened to me is not even the tiniest tip of the iceberg of what is happening to women around the world. It just happened publicly and it happened on camera. So finally, there will be an opportunity for other people to view this, and if they have open minds and hearts, to see it for what it really is.
The annual Women's Memorial March is held on Valentine's Day each year to honor the memory of all women from the downtown East Side who have died due to violence. Maddie Schmidt from CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby brings you this report.
In 1995, when I started marching, there was like 15 of us up really? And down these streets. So to see this is somewhat overwhelming for me.
And just to see so much community come together for one purpose, it lightens my heart. And
I don't know. I guess sometimes I'm kind of in shock whenever I see how many times that we stop, because whenever we stop, it means that they found another body of another woman who was murdered. And I don't even remember how many times we've stopped today.
I don't think that people should die. I don't get it.
A lot of joy and a lot of sadness for all our relations and all our sisters that passed away. And I'm just proud and so happy to be here. I'm just full of joy to see all these ladies and the families here. It's a good day.
You just heard speeches from the annual Women's Memorial March, which took place last weekend on the 14th of February in Vancouver's downtown East Side. Hundreds of people took the streets and marched for missing and murdered Indigenous women. Family members clutched photos of lost daughters and sisters as they marched, stopping to lay roses at spots where loved ones were killed. The first march took place in 1991 in response to the murder of a Coast Salish woman on Paul Street in Vancouver. The march was founded out of anger and hopelessness. It expresses community, compassion, and caring for all Indigenous women. I attended this event. It began with a press conference where family members spoke in remembrance at the Carnegie Community Center Theatre on Main Street Hastings. There was a gathering with drummers in a circle, family inside, and a crowd outside. We marched around 2 blocks, came back to Main Hastings, and then more people spoke.
This This is my daughter. Yeah. My only daughter. I'll never get to dance at her wedding.
Nope.
Remember me, Harper. When you dance at your son or your daughter's wedding, I can't. My memories are gone forever.
My sister was murdered in 1992, and the last time I seen her was at the Balmoral. And with the grief and the loss, I didn't know how to handle myself. And I turned to drugs and alcohol. And I, too, ended up at Hastings in Maine. All my friends were going missing and murdered. All the working girls, all my sisters, and they're gone. I felt guilty because I survived and they didn't. Why was it me and why was it not them? I remember at my two-year cake saying those words, why was it me and not, was it them? And today I stand here at Maine and Hastings, clean and sober around the sacred circle, stating that that's why, because my voice is being heard today. December 28th. 2012, I was beaten by myself and I was so ashamed. And then I went to court last year. I had 11 years clean and sober, and I stood in that courtroom testifying against my abuser, the one that beat me. He rubbed red marks on my neck. And his judge brought up the fact that I was an ape, that I didn't testify at the Picton trial. They threw that in my face, and I didn't know what to do with the trauma that came up.
Then we walked to Oppenheimer Park, where we conducted a healing circle. They gave everybody candles, including me. The woman inside the circle sang a song. During the song, we turned north, west, south, and east. After this ceremony, we all entered the circle and placed the candles around a pole and prayed. After the healing circle, we headed to the Japanese Language Hall and finally had a community feast with live music and performances. This is Maddie Schmidt reporting from CJSF 90.1 FM. On the traditional land of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations for Groundwire.
Up next, Mina Ramos brings us this report on a rally organized by high school youth outside an Ontario prison on Family Day.
This past Family Day, over 100 individuals gathered at the Central East Correctional Center, a maximum security prison in Lindsay, Ontario, to protest indefinite immigration detention in Canada and support detainees who have been engaging in ongoing strikes since September 2013. Organized entirely by youth, the rally highlighted how individuals are unjustly separated from their families and placed into maximum security prisons while they await pending deportation. Family members of current and former immigration detainees took part in the event and spoke on the need for support and change in immigration policy. Pam Sheraldini, wife of Masood Hajivan, a current detainee, took to the mic to speak on her family's experience with immigration detention. The following is an excerpt of her speech.
My husband is inside this jail for the past 8 months. He has no charges. And his life is in very extreme danger if they deport him. It's very difficult for us every week to come here all the way for only 20 minutes behind the glass to see him and talk to him. And all I'm asking to whoever is listening to me to stop this deportation and let these people to be with their families. Thank you. Thank you for all to be here. Thank you.
Protesters, wanting to be seen by the detainees themselves, walked around the perimeter of the prison towards Pod 3, where immigration detainees are currently held. The crowd chanted, banged on pots and pans, and were silent when they realized they could hear the people on the inside of the prison banging on the windows in response. Upon arrival to Pod 3, a youth involved in organizing the rally grew emotional as she spoke on the injustice of immigration detention and had this to say.
Canada's anti-
immigration system is anything but generous. It is a system that separates families, forces parents to make impossible decisions, keeps families apart by not giving them immigration status, keeps them apart by locking them in jails like this, keeps people from being with the ones they love the most. This system is unjust and cruel, and we as youth cannot remain silent about this. So on behalf of Youth for Global Change, I'm here to say we all deserve to be with our loved ones on Family Day.
The Central East Correctional Center is currently one of many maximum security facilities used to house immigrants slated for deportation. Some of the prisoners are long-term detainees, people immigration enforcement cannot deport but will not release. Others have been designated as high security based on prior criminal history, but this can be as little as an arrest that has not led to a conviction. Some people have been in jail for over 7 years because Canada, unlike the US and UK, has no limit on how long someone can be held prior to deportation. Since September 16, 2013, detainees at the Central East Correctional Center have undergone a series of strikes calling for the following demands. 1. Release all migrant detainees who have been held longer for 90 days. This is the presumptive period that exists in the U.S. and the U.K. 2. Immigration detainees should not be held in maximum security provincial jails. They must have access to basic services and be close to family members. 3. Give migrants fair and full access to legal aid, bail programs, and pro bono representation. On July 24, 2014, the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights issued the opinion that Canada is abusing its use of immigration detention. Despite this, little has been done by the government to change policy around this issue. Until changes are made, detainees at the Central East Correctional Center will continue their strike. This is Mina Ramos reporting from CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph on unceded Attawandaron territory for Groundwire.
CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston is hosting the 13th Homelessness Marathon. Groundwire is producing a special edition focusing on homelessness that will air during the marathon with headlines and features from stations across the country. Filza Navid from CFRC interviews Brenna Owen, coordinator of the marathon, who talks about the purpose of the marathon, its history, and the meaning of homelessness.
This is Filza Navid reporting from CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On Wednesday, February 25th to Thursday, February 26th, 2015, CFRC in Kingston will host the 2015 Homelessness Marathon. The yearly overnight broadcast is shared on campus and community stations from coast to coast, creating linkages and raising awareness of homelessness in Canadian communities. The Homelessness Marathon is currently in its 13th year in Canada and is made possible by members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, also known as the NCRA. This year, 14 campus and community stations from 6 provinces are contributing to the marathon. Brenna Owen from CFRC, who is coordinating the marathon and is also CFRC's spoken word and special programming coordinator, talks about the background of the marathon, how it came to be, what homelessness means, and the purpose of the marathon. Is this the first time CFRC is hosting the Homelessness Marathon? When did the tradition start?
Yeah, this is the first time that CFRC will host the marathon. So I'll give you a little bit of background information. The Homelessness Marathon started in the United States 17 years ago, actually, in New York, at a station in New York, and it's been moving around the country ever since. So the marathon came to Canada 13 years ago. The marathon is in its 13th year. When CKUT in Montreal took up the cause. So someone named Gretchen and a few other folks, one of whom named Andy, is actually going to make his way down to our very own marathon in February. They started it at CKUT, and it was hosted by CKUT for 11 years, as far as I know. And last year, in the 12th year, it moved to CJSR in Edmonton. And this year, CFRC is the host. So as the marathon progressed, more features were added, like a national call-in line, and also more stations contributed to the marathon. So for the first few years, as I as I understand, it was mostly a CKUT endeavor. But then CJSR had a lot of participants, and this year we've got 14 stations, including CFRC, contributing at least half an hour of content.
You also did a documentary on homelessness. Could you let listeners know, especially those people who may not know, what exactly homelessness means and what's the purpose of the marathon?
Yeah, so I personally did a documentary with CFRC last year, and that, I guess I'll use the word, inspired me to kind of take on coordinating the marathon for CFRC, because what I realized when I did this documentary, which is called Beyond Closed Doors, is that hidden homelessness is extremely prevalent. So homelessness isn't the panhandler that we see on the street. That is chronic homelessness. But many more people who we might know, who we've gone to school with, have experienced hidden homelessness at one time or another. So the marathon is about shining a light on the diversity of people who experience homelessness and the diversity of reasons that people experience homelessness. And also, you know, when people experience homelessness, what happens to them? What, you know, problems do they encounter? Mental health problems, you know, everyday problems like food and shelter. So the marathon prioritizes giving a voice to, or a platform, sorry, a platform for the voices of folks who have lived experience with homelessness. So at our open mic at Martha's Table from 4 till 6 p.m. on February 25th, we're going to have folks share their stories about homelessness in Kingston and in other places. I would just encourage everyone to come to the marathon, because I don't think we'll be hosting it for a while again in future. It's great that it travels around the country. You know, CKUT, CJSR, and CFRC are the stations that have hosted it in Canada. So it could be in Halifax next year. It could be in BC. So this is a chance to come down, talk to people, and meet some people you wouldn't meet otherwise. CFRC volunteers, folks who are experiencing homelessness, who have experienced homelessness and are in a different situation now. There's also just going to be like food and conversation. So I highly encourage everyone to come out to Martha's Table from 4 till 6 p.m. on February 25th. That's a Wednesday. And then we'll move the broadcast overnight outside from 7 p.m. until 6 in the morning on the lawn of St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church. There will be a warm space, so don't let the early hours be daunting. It's going to be a warm space with the Kingston Street Mission until 6 in the morning.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. This has been Carrie Tatwini.
And Julian Cooper from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Headlines this week were by Michael Welch and Marilla Studer-Martin.
Features were by Gennarzio O'Sullivan, Maddie Schmidt, Mina Ramos, and Filza Navid.
Orfea Horwitz produced the episode.
The Groundwire public service announcement was recorded by Lila Lemangalif with music by Common Vernacular. You can download his music at soundcloud.com/common-vernacular.
We also thank Megan Thomas.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download this and past episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca. You can also find Groundwire on the NCRA Program Exchange page, radioforall.net, Media Co-op, and on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca/podcasts/shows/groundwire.